welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast 121. My name is Terry Frost, and this time around, we're looking at a couple of very, very fine films. The first one is the 1960 courtroom drama Inherit the Wind, starring Spencer Tracy and Frederick March and Gene Kelly. And the other one is one of the great films noir of the 1950s, in this case 1953, and the film is The Big Heat, starring Glenn Ford, Lee Marvin, Alexander Scorby, and, of course, Gloria Graham. So sit back, relax, and we will get on with the podcast. Paleo Cinema Podcast is a podcast of movie appreciation. I do any movie more than 20 years old, and I will go all the way back to silent films if I absolutely have to. Feedback's one of the important things with a podcast, so you can supply feedback via the email address cultguru, K-U-L-T-G-U-R-U @gmail.com is the primary way of doing this. There is also a voicemail line which you can leave voicemails on, and it's area code 206-338-9397. Now that's changed recently, so use that. You can go to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook as well and join a few little discussions about movies that way. Now this podcast does contain some adult material at times, so if you're not into that, fast forward through those bits and just enjoy the rest of the podcast anyway. Hi people, how is everybody? As I speak, I'm looking out the window at some heavy rain, so if you hear some rain noise in the background, it's not just bad audio quality, it is actual precipitation bashing against the windows of the man cave and interfering with my dulcet tones. I hope everybody's doing fine. We're doing sort of okay here. Sal's father is somewhat ill, but we're managing that as best we can under the circumstances and getting geared up for Sal's 40th birthday later this month. And if you want to say happy 40th birthday to Sal, send me a voicemail and I will play them for her on her birthday and probably embarrass and piss her off. So, having said that, the weather here is, as you can guess, hit and miss. We're getting some warm days and then we're getting some cold days with some rain. Our brand newly minted federal government is in deep denial mode about global warming and have stopped the carbon tax and things like that. We've had incredibly hot temperatures and bushfires in New South Wales. We've had weird temperatures down here. The extremes are more extreme. And yet the government says that everything will be okay if we just get the economics right. So after that political rant, and I know I've been doing that a little bit in the podcast, and I do apologise, I'm going to let you know that the movies we've got this time are really good. Inherit the Wind I've wanted to do for a while, but I had a bit of a trouble tracking down a decent copy of it that was widescreen and a decent enough quality to let me enjoy the movie. I know I've done Spencer Tracy twice in three podcasts, but I'm on a bit of a Spencer Tracy kick at the moment, and I got an enormous biography of him very cheaply a few months ago, and so I want to get the best use out of my research materials. And then the other film is another one that I've wanted to do for a while, The Big Heat, starring Glenn Ford and Lee Marvin and Gloria Graham, directed by Fritz Lang, a classic of the genre, but with a few twists that make it somewhat different than your classic stock standard film noir. But I'll talk about that in a little bit. Now, what have I been watching? And I actually have everything ready to tell you what I've been watching lately that is of interest. I did see Kick-Ass 2, which was kind of okay. I enjoyed that more than I should have, perhaps, which goes to show where my head's at with these things. Let me see. I'm trying to save the science fiction and fantasy things that I saw for doing the Martian Driving podcast, which I'm also going to record this weekend because I've decided I'm going to do both podcasts fortnightly just to really challenge myself. I did see a movie called 24 Hours to Kill, which is a kind of Eurocrime, Eurospy drama from the 1960s starring Lex Barker and Mickey Rooney. It's set in Beirut and filmed in Beirut, and it's kind of interesting because of that. And it's got a nice gritty ending to it. It turned up on Turner Classic Movies. Now, I don't know whether it's going to turn up on Turner Classic Movies where you are, because the Movies that show are different depending on whether it's Australia or Asia or America. The Turner Classic Movies are showing things. But I enjoyed it. I think it's great. They've got a very good car chase through the hills behind Beirut and a few other bits and pieces. It's not a large budget movie, but it might be worth checking out if you're interested in that sort of thing. Let me see. I've been watching a lot of genre films. I did bite the poison apple and saw Alex Cross, the Tyler Perry action film. He's a bad actor, isn't he? Tyler Perry doesn't really hit our radar much in Australia. His drag queen movies don't show up here in any meaningful way unless somebody wants to torrent them. But it was a dog's breakfast of a film. Really not very good at all. And I don't recommend that people see it. I'm glad I saw it on cable because I would have been really pissed off if I had to pay cash money to see the bloody thing. Just wrong in a number of different ways. I did go the large budget action film route and saw White House Down, which is kind of Die Hard in the White House with Obama, played by Jamie Foxx. Basically, it's a standard generic genre film. You know, there's a few twists and plot twists and some good character actors doing okay, but not marvellously well in there. If you're in the mood for a meathead movie, I recommend that you watch it. If you're not, then maybe something else. But it's no better and no worse than a lot of other things of a similar ilk. I did see another Spencer Tracy movie. As I said, I'm on a bit of a Spencer Tracy kick at the moment. And I saw a movie he did with John Ford in the 1950s called The Last Hurrah, which is about a mayoral election in a town that may or may not be Boston in the 1950s, and the incumbent who's been in there for six or seven electoral cycles, played by Spencer Tracy, is going up against a new kind of politician, backed by some very strongly vested interests. It's not a bad, it's a minor Ford movie, but it's not too bad at all. And Tracy is supported by a very, very fine supporting cast of people whose names aren't really known, but who are from the John Ford favourite actor stable. And that's kind of good. It does have a few interesting people, and it does have John Carradine in it, for instance, and Basil Rathbone playing vested interests, and Jeffrey Hunter playing a young journalist who happens to be the mayor's nephew. And, it's an interesting period piece almost. Not perfect, and tonally it's very out of place with the mood of the 1950s. It has a very 1930s, 1940s mood about it. But if you want to see a John Ford film that maybe you haven't seen, The Last Hurrah is probably the one to go for. And because it is a John film, it's not less than interesting. So that's about it for what I've been watching. I'm going to leave the rest of the genre stuff for Martian Drive-In, which I'm recording immediately after this. Larynx pending, depending on how my throat goes. It's not particularly worrying me, but I find that my throat does have a little bit of a pain sometimes after I've recorded a long podcast. But anyway, I'm going to take a break now. And when I get back, we're going to take a look at Inherit the Wind, a 1960 movie starring Spencer Tracy, Gene Kelly, Frederick March, Dick York, and a number of other people, including Harry Morgan playing the judge, which is basically a slight dramatization of the Scopes monkey trial from 1925. Makes it of great interest to me. But before I do take a break, I wanted to play the audio from my radio gig, because I'm back doing a radio gig with Ivor Cole, and it's about music of the movies. And they did a little bit of a track there to introduce me. Now, this audio quality isn't great because I haven't got the original materials yet. Ivor is sending me copies of what we've done, which is going to be groovy for me to have. But I just thought I'd play this to, in case people are interested.
The music of the movies with Terry Frost.
Ladies and gentlemen, My name is Stanley Kramer. Nowadays, a motion picture producer engages in a great variety and types of battle. I've been in one or two myself. But I think that in my own career, nothing can possibly rival the excitement and the provocation of the battle which I have recently finished refereeing, in a manner of speaking. I refer to the battle and the clash in a motion picture film known as Inherit the Wind. Now, the protagonists or antagonists in this battle are Spencer Tracy and Frederick March, both two-time winners of the Academy Award.
God speaks to Brady, and Brady tells the world. Brady, Brady, Brady Almighty!
The Lord is my strength!
I object, I object, I object!
On what grounds? Is it possible that something is holy to the celebrated agnostic?
Yes, the individual human mind.
They are the generations of the holy men and women of the Bible.
How'd they go about all this begetting?
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, did they beget in much the same way as folks get themselves begat today?
Process is about the same. I don't think your scientists have improved it any.
You win no victories here.
I've been a lawyer long enough to know there are no total victories anywhere.
There's only one man in this town that thinks at all, and he's in jail.
That's why I'm here.
Inherit the Wind makes news everywhere. London, celebrities arrive for the world premiere. Producer Stanley Kramer arrives. Gregory Peck. Filmmakers Otto Preminger and Walter Wanger. Gene Kelly, co-star of Inherit the Wind. And Jeff Chandler. Berlin. Inherit the Wind electrifies the Berlin Film Festival. Record throngs turn out, and a gala list of celebrities and dignitaries, headed by Berlin's mayor, Willy Brandt. Inherit the Wind becomes the first picture ever to win two awards at the festival. A coveted Silver Bear Award presented to Stanley Kramer by Harold Lloyd, chairman of the festival jury. And a special youth award for the best picture voted by teenagers all over the country. For its brilliant performances and dramatic power, unprecedented acclaim for Inherit the Wind.
Oh, God speaks to you?
Yes.
He tells you what is right and wrong?
Yes.
And you act accordingly?
Yes.
So you, Matthew Harrison Brady, through oratory or legislature or whatever, you pass on God's orders to the rest of the world. Well, meet the prophet from Nebraska. Is that the way of things?
The winner, you'll have to make that decision for yourselves when you see Inherit the Wind. But I would promise you an experience in screen performance beyond anything you have ever seen.
So that was one of the trailers they did for Inherit the Wind back in 1960, showing how well the movie was regarded. It's a pretty simple story in essence. It's based on a play from 1955 by Jerome Lawrence and Robert Edwin Lee, which was a dramatization of the Scopes Monkey Trial from 1925, where a school teacher called Scopes was taken to court because the state law said that you can't teach evolution in schools. Now, I believe that that is still quite a hot-button topic in certain parts of the US, and really, it shouldn't be. Now, the Scopes Monkey Trial was a fantastic media event at the time. You had Clarence Darrow on one side, eminent lawyer, agnostic slash atheist, incredible humanist, versus William Jennings Bryan, a Bible basher who ran for president three times unsuccessfully and was a big wheel on the Chautauqua circuit in the 19-teens and 1920s, which was a kind of lecture circuit where well-known speakers and intellectuals went around and various country towns and cities in the US and did educational talks to get the masses educated in a certain way and to at least foster the illusion that they were going to progress was a good thing and an important thing and all that kind of stuff. So in the movie, Spencer Tracy plays, in essence, Clarence Darrow, though the character in the movie and in the play is called Henry Drummond, and Frederick March plays Matthew Harrison Brady, who was patterned after William Jennings Bryan. You got Gene Kelly in there as well, playing a journalist from the Boston Herald called E.K. Hornbeck, who was kind of H.L. Mencken. Florence Eldridge, who was Frederick March's wife, plays Matthew Brady's wife, Sarah, and has a couple of very, very fine scenes. Her and Frederick March were married for a very long time until their deaths. Dick York, who people remember as the first Darren in Bewitched, stars as Bertram T. Cates, who was John Scopes in the thing. His girlfriend, Ms. Rachel Brown, is played by Donna Anderson, who does a very good job for an actor who didn't work very long in the industry. She does quite a decent job in that. You got Harry Morgan playing Judge Mel Coffey, Claude Akins playing Rachel's father, the Reverend Jeremiah Brown. Now, Claude Akins we remember for playing kind of redneck characters and slightly comical characters in 1970s TV series. But in this, he is an incredibly nasty, Bible-bashing, fucking insane preacher, basically. You've got Noah Beery Jr., who has a very good scene as well. People like Norman Fell show up and Ray Teal, which is kind of interesting. And most of it takes place in a stinking hot courtroom in the middle of summer where the trial of ideas carries on. Now, Spencer Tracy wasn't particularly a well man at the time. He'd gone into a kind of rehab thing to lose some weight and to get his health in place, but it didn't work. He was unfortunately becoming alcoholic. And if you have a look at Spencer Tracy 5 years before this in, say, Bad Day at Black Rock, which I talked about a couple of podcasts ago to this movie, you can see that he's kind of aged a lot for 5 years. And if you have a look at him 5 years before that, in movies he did around 1950, you can see that his health is just ebbing. He died in 1967 after making Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, which he does incredibly well. And him and Catherine Hepburn in that are mind-blowingly good. I really should hit that one up for a Paleo Cinema podcast sometime in the future. It's well-meaning and a bit naive about race relations compared to the nuanced and complex stuff we have going now, but it's an interesting film and a very humanist one. And Spencer Tracy really is the voice of humanism in Inherit the Wind. Even though in real life he was a devout Catholic, I think that his liberal bias, and I mean liberal not in the Australian sense, but in the broader sense, really allows him to play the humanist Brady very, very well. Though there is a bit at the end where he picks up both Origin of Species and the Bible and carries them out of the courthouse, which for me felt a little bit like a cop-out. But having said that, I love a good courtroom drama. I mean, I've talked about Witness for the Prosecution before. One of the lovely things about courtroom dramas in cinema is that they're shorthand. Yeah, usually you've got to build up antagonism and, you know, the clash of hero, goody versus baddie, that kind of thing. But in a courtroom drama, it's all there already. You've got the template of the court itself. You've got the crime. You've got the accused. You've got the defense. You've got the prosecution. You've got the judge. You've got the jury. You've got the people watching the trial. So basically you've got a lot of different ways to have different viewpoints on the plot. So courtroom dramas are kind of like a distilled essence of drama in a sense. And it can be done very well. When it's done badly, it's what tends to happen is the focus is entirely on the prosecutor and the defense attorney and maybe the defendant. But having that broader viewpoint and having that broader approach to things is when a courtroom drama really comes into its own, as it did in Witness for the Prosecution and as it does for Inherit the Wind, which came out pretty much the same time too, which I like the sound of. I don't think courtroom dramas work in cinema like they used to, because television is replete with them. We've got entire shows that are basically about that to a more or lesser extent, an entire 20-year-long TV series which are about that legal process. And so a courtroom drama in cinema has to be something very, very special for it to get any traction at all. But the acting in this is fantastic. One of the interesting things, and from a genre point of view, is both Spencer Tracy and Frederick March in the 1930s played Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, which is kind of cool. I like the idea of them. It's like having Christopher Lee and Frank Langella in the same movie because they both played Dracula, that kind of thing. But Frederick March, very underrated actor these days. People don't hear much about Frederick March, but he did a number of great roles. And right up until he did The Iceman Cometh, he was dying of cancer in the 1970s when he did The Iceman Cometh with Robert Ryan and Lee Marvin, who of course is in The Big Heat, which I'm going to talk about in a little bit. But I think Frederick March is an underrated actor, and in a sense something of a forgotten actor these days. And his character in this film, based on William Jennings Bryan, the Matthew Brady character, is past his prime. I mean, both he and Drummond are men of a certain age. But Brady's past his prime. He's tried to be President of the United States 3 times unsuccessfully. He's not working on the Chautauqua circuit anymore. He comes in for, in a sense, to use a phrase from another Spencer Tracy movie, it's his last hurrah, prosecuting this case against this poor little school teacher who just wants to teach science in a science class. And he wants to teach the best science that he can avail himself of, which is, in this sense, evolution. And there's a scene right at the start where the town, the powers that be in the town, march into the back of his classroom as the Dick York character is teaching evolution, and they arrest him and he has his photo taken in the classroom with his students there. And it shows that there's a politics going on as well. The town council has a meeting when the news of the trial becomes big news across the country. And they talk about the pros and cons of continuing with this prosecution, whether it's going to make them look like they're idiots, whether it's good for the town in the sense that it's going to bring money into the town, whether it's bad for business, whether it's bad for the banks. And the interesting thing about this too is the town banker is on the side of fairness a lot more than the other people who are powers in the town, which I kind of like. Part of it is self-interest as well. He knows that he's going to have trouble negotiating with larger big city banks if they're seen as to be rednecks where he is. But he also has a great humanist sense, which comes to play later in the movie when he pays for one of the characters' bail money and backs it up, along with a farmer who has been grievously harmed by the Bible bashers of the town. And I like that too. I like the fact that there are a range of opinions in the town. They're not just all, you know, pitchforks and torches when it comes to this trial. There are a range of opinions. There are some people, including one of the jurors, who's mainly indifferent to the whole discussion. And that makes for interesting fiction. But getting back to the two protagonists, Henry Drummond, played by Spencer Tracy, was previously in the world of the movie, but not in the real life, a friend of Matthew Brady and his wife. And there are a couple of scenes where there's a scene where the two men are sitting on a rocking chair in the place where outside the place where they're both boarding and talking about the past. And Spencer Tracy's character tells a story about a rocking horse, which is kind of interesting because they're both rocking on rocking chairs. And the lovely direction by Stanley Kramer in this is the fact that the two rocking chairs are out of pace with each other. They're kind of counterpoint rocking to each other as Spencer Tracy tells a story. And as the trial and the story goes on, Matthew Brady character, played by Frederick March, becomes more and more pathetic and desperate. Even though he's probably going to win the trial, his emphasis becomes him and his oratory, him and his opinions, him and the spotlight, which makes for a quite a pointed scene towards the end of the film. Whereas Henry Drummond knows he's not going to win, knows that most of the people in the town and most of the people in the jury are instinctively against his client and instinctively against the rationalist, humanist approach that he is bringing to the game. And it's a lovely thing. The films, the courtroom scenes in particular and a few of the other scenes are in very long takes. The takes are 3 to 5 minutes long, which for the actors was a blessing. They didn't have to stop and then find the same place again when they recut. They were given the leeway and the headroom to act kind of like stage acting. And this was backed up by the fact they had 250 extras in the courtroom scenes. And when one of these long takes would end, they would applaud the protagonists and the actors who were in the foreground, which boosted them up because both of them were stage actors as much as cinema actors in their early careers. And having that applause lifted their game for them and let them kind of revel and find the right tone and the right place in their acting. And there isn't a bad piece of acting in this film. It really is great stuff. Now, you've got to remember that this was filmed in 1916. They were talking about life in 1925 America, which was very different from life in 1960 America. You've got to remember 35 years, that difference. There's a lot more difference between 1925 and 1960 than there is between 2013 and 1978, which is the equivalent time in the past. Yes, allowing for computer technology, apart from that societal, in a societal sense, there's less of a difference between us and people of 1978 than there were of people in 1960 and people in 1925. It was a simpler world with simpler media. They'd been through one war, but not two wars. They didn't have nuclear weapons. They didn't have the civil rights movement. They didn't have a whole bunch of other stuff. They didn't have television. They didn't have the complexities of media that 1960 had compared to 1925. And that's shown in the film, which is kind of interesting as well. They've actually got a radio broadcast from the town being done, and the townspeople, you see the townspeople reacting to that in a few interesting ways. Now, the cinematography is also very, very fine. Ernest Laszlo did the cinematography and was nominated for an Oscar for it, as was Spencer Tracy as well. Ernest Laszlo did a whole bunch of really fine movies. He did a couple of movies I've talked about. In fact, he worked with Robert Aldrich a bit. He did movies that I've talked about in the podcast before: Apache and Vera Cruz, The Naked Jungle, The Big Knife, Kiss Me Deadly. He also went on to do for Stanley Kramer Judgment at Nuremberg and It's a Mad, 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 Mad World. And later on did Logan's Run. He was the cinematographer on Logan's Run as well. And his black and white cinematography in this film is terrific. It was done on the sound stages in Hollywood. And it was the only movie being made on the sound stages at the time because all the rest was being used for television series. So it was an interesting time when the old school sound stages were mostly being used for episodic television rather than for film, which was commented on by people like Spencer Tracy during the making of the movie. And there was a bit of one-upmanship between Spencer Tracy and Frederick March in the film as well, which kind of was a lot of fun. They'd known each other for decades at this stage, maybe 30 years at this stage, and there was a friendly rivalry between them. And one of the things Spencer Tracy said, and this is a direct quote, and you've got to remember it was a very hot courthouse and everybody's using little fans. And Spencer Tracy said of Frederick March, "He keeps waving that fucking fan. Has a bit of business to draw attention to himself in a lot of the courtroom scenes." So there was that going on as well, but they all got on fine. And Stanley Kramer went on to make other films with Spencer Tracy, including Judgment at Nuremberg and It's a Mad, 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 Mad World. So from all reports, including Gene Kelly, who does a very fine piece of serious acting. Gene Kelly wasn't known for his dramatic acting at the time, was quite nervous about doing it, but he did say in later years that even though he didn't learn a lot from Spencer Tracy, because Spencer Tracy didn't have the kind of acting that gave tips to other actors, but it was all there. He kind of thought about it, he'd work it out himself, and he would then unravel it, unreel it at the right time. And it's only in retrospect that the other actors could see what he'd done and how he'd done it. He had a kind of invisible preparation in a sense, which in spite of that really came out in the acting. And this is one of his best later acting roles. And I like it a lot. I like the fact that the ideas being espoused in this movie are ideas that unfortunately we've still got to fight the battles for. We've still got to fight the fight against ignorance and reflexive compliance to ancient codes rather than the more, for me, more reasonable approach, which is to use evidence as the way to move forward as a species, in a sense, an evidence-based reality rather than mythology-based reality. And one of the things that Kramer does, particularly when there is a rally by the Reverend, played by Claude Akins, shows how religious zealotry damages human beings and damages relationships and has a cruel righteousness about it, which really is a bad force in the world. And that scene, even though the character played by Claude Akins is over the top, is not unlike a lot of things you'll see on YouTube videos of religious zealots these days. It's a movie that hasn't dated for that reason, because those ideas are still being played out in our world. And it's a nice companion piece. If I was going to do a double feature with this film, I would do the other movie of the time, which is based on Clarence Darrow court cases, and that would probably be Compulsion, the movie with Orson Welles playing the Clarence Darrow-type character in the Leopold and Loeb story with Bradford Dillman and Dean Stockwell playing the accused in that. I think that they're two really good humanist movies with the same real-life character in them of the time, talking about two totally separate issues. One, of course, being the right to teach evolution, the other being capital punishment. So they're both great movies, and maybe I should have done that. Maybe I should have done this for the podcast where I played them both against each other as a part of this podcast, but it's a bit late for me to think of that now. But having said that, Inherit the Wind, it's been remade a couple of times as a TV movie just because it is such a great courtroom drama and a great drama of ideas. It was done in 1965 as a television film with Melvin Douglas and Ed Begley in the roles. Ed Begley played the Brady character on the original stage version as well. It was done in 1988 with Jason Robards, Kirk Douglas and Darren McGavin in it. And it was done in 1999 with Jack Lemmon, George C. Scott, and Beau Bridges. So it's one of those stories that is being retold as the need arises. But I think going back to the 1960 film is the way to go. I don't think that anything is gained by the later versions except to see how different actors carry the roles. But having said that, I'm going to finish up with Inherit the Wind now. I think it's a fine film. It's a movie that... it's one of those ones, again, that I really like, but I don't want to see too often because I don't want the power of them to diminish by repetition. And there are a lot of movies like that out there that you want to watch, but you don't dare because you don't want them to weaken. So having said that, I'm going to take another break now. And when I get back, I'm going to talk about a very, very different kind of movie, being 1953's The Big Heat with Glenn Ford, Lee Marvin, and Gloria Graham in it.
All right. The defense has brought to Hillsborough a great expense and great inconvenience. 6 noted scientists. Their testimony is basic to the defense of my client. For I intend to show this court that what Bertram Cates spoke quietly one spring morning in the Hillsborough High School is no crime. It is incontrovertible as geometry to any enlightened community of minds.
In this community, Colonel Drummond, and in this sovereign state, exactly the opposite is the case. The language of the law is clear, Your Honor. We do not need experts to question the validity of a law that is already on the books.
Well, what do you need? A gallows to hang him from?
That remark is an insult to this entire community.
And this community is an insult to the world. Your Honor, I request permission to withdraw from this case.
Mr. Drummond, you can't quit now.
Why not? You were ready 5 minutes ago.
Colonel Drummond, what reasons can you possibly have?
Well, there are 200 of them. And if that's not enough, there's one more. I think my client has already been found guilty.
Is Mr. Drummond saying that this expression of an honest emotion will in any way influence the court's impartial administration of the law?
I say that you cannot administer a wicked law impartially. You can only destroy, you can only punish. And I warn you that a wicked law like cholera destroys everyone it touches, its upholders as well as its defiers.
Colonel Drummond,
can't you understand that if you take a law like evolution and you make it a crime to teach it in the public schools, tomorrow you can make it a crime to teach it in the private schools, and tomorrow you may make it a crime to read about it, and soon you may ban books and newspapers. And then you may turn Catholic against Protestant, and Protestant against Protestant, and try to foist your own religion upon the mind of man. If you can do one, you can do the other. Because fanaticism and ignorance is forever busy and needs feeding. And soon, Your Honor, with banners flying and with drums beating, we'll be marching backward, backward, through the glorious ages of that 16th century, when bigots burned the man who dared bring enlightenment and intelligence to the human mind.
The room was dark, it looked like someone had to get out fast. A window opened by the fire escape. How long have you been following this guy? The bellboy asked. Not long enough, 'cause we got here too late.
Everybody wants another piece of pie today, he said. You gotta watch the ones who always keep their hands clean.
It's the big heat. There's someone following you, it's the big heat. Step aside, we're coming through. Well, we followed him from Tucson, ended up in Baton Rouge. We trailed him here with information by a woman he knew at Barstow that would like to see him dead. That was 4 weeks ago, well, maybe 5.
Everybody wants another piece of pie today, she said. You gotta watch the ones who always keep their hands clean.
It's the big heat.
Someone
it's the big heap. There's someone following you.
It's the beast.
Step aside, we're coming through. Wondered if he'd left behind a clue. The front page of the paper, dated 1992. He remembered when he used to be the chairman of the board. But that was when the world was young and long before the war. Everybody wants another piece of.
That was Stan Ridgway's 1986 song, The Big Heat, partly inspired by the movie I'm about to talk about. In fact, it's one of the best time travel songs you're ever going to hear, because the song was written in 1986 and it talks about a newspaper with a headline in 1992. So obviously the guy is a time traveler. So having said that, we're going to get on with a little bit of classic Fritz Lang. Everybody knows Fritz Lang. He directed Metropolis. He directed Ministry of Fear. He directed M with Peter Lorre. He was in Le Mépris, the Jean-Luc Godard movie. And he is just one of the go-to guys if you want to have a good film watching experience. In fact, I'm going to read a bit from Glenn Ford, A Life by his son Peter Ford, where Glenn Ford talks about working with Fritz Lang in The Big Heat. Fritz Lang came out of the old German studio system where the director was like a dictator, barking commands and making people jump. He had a pretty nasty reputation in some quarters. There were people in Hollywood who had worked with him who hated his guts, especially some of the crew guys down the line. I mean, there were stories of people throwing lights at him and threatening to kill him for the way he treated them. So I head into this picture wondering how bad it's going to be, and then Fritz and I meet and had a couple of cocktails, and he couldn't have been sweeter. He treated me with great respect, a wonderful friend, and I learned so much from him. We're talking about one of the real geniuses of the movie business. So that's Glenn Ford talking about that. Glenn Ford had made a few movies. He was very, very well known for playing Gilda in Gilda. He didn't play Gilda. That was done by Rita Hayworth. But he was good at playing weak/strong characters, and there's always I always find an ambiguity in the characters that Glenn Ford plays in a movie. Because of that, I find that, you know, because he wasn't particularly a tall guy, and he was very much an everyman kind of looking guy, and particularly in this film, he makes some incredibly bad decisions. I always find a moral ambivalence about the characters that Glenn Ford plays. I'll just read you the blurb from IMDb by somebody calling himself Alfie Hitchie. Dave Banyan is an upright but unscrupulous cop on the trail of a vicious gang he suspects hold power over the police force. Banyan is tipped off after a colleague's suicide, and his fellow officers' suspicious silence lead him to believe that they are on the gangster's payroll. When a bomb meant for him kills his wife instead, Banyan becomes a furious force of vengeance and justice, aided along the way by the gangster's spurned girlfriend Debbie, played by Gloria Graham. As Banyan and Debbie fall further and further into the gangland's insidious trap, They must use any means necessary, including murder, to get to the truth. Now, that's not exactly right, but it's close enough to give you a bit of an idea. Right at the start of the film, there's a nice scene where a man sitting at a desk in a large house shoots himself in the head. And his wife, played by Jeanette Nolan, walks in, sees him, sees the letter he's written spilling his guts about his involvement with the Jacana crime syndicate. Jacana being played by an actor called Alexander Scorby. His wife picks up the letter, reads it, and then calls Jacana, who tells her to thank you for the call, but call the cops now and we'll work it all out later. Basically, she's going to be blackmailing the crime syndicate to keep her mouth shut about the information provided by her now dead husband, which is pretty cold. And the Jeanette Nolan character is a cold, cold woman in the movie. And it doesn't end well for her. Name's Bertha Duncan, and her husband was a high police officer. So along comes Detective Sergeant Dave Banyan, played by Glenn Ford, who goes at everything like a bull in a china shop. He bails up Jacana. He kicks over tables. He does everything he can to piss off these guys. And he's the one who suffers for it, but it's not necessarily him who suffers for all this stuff. One thing that's been said about this movie, which seems to be spot on, is that it's a reverse film noir. In a standard film noir, as we all know because we love film noir, men are betrayed by ruthless and unscrupulous women, and it doesn't end well for the men, and they die in some way because they've been fucked over by an incredibly attractive but psychopathic chick. That's your standard film noir in quite rough terms. And by the way, I shouldn't have called them chicks then, because I apologise to my friend Elaine. I misspoke then. I should have said women. Having said that, in this movie, the women get a really rough trot because Dave Banyan's got a temper. For a start, his wife gets blown up in a car because he goes and bails up Jacana. There's a nightclub waitress who was a friend of the late blown his own brains out policeman, who Dave just approaches in a nightclub and starts having a talk to, and all the crimps see it, and then basically torture and kill her. Then, of course, there's a lady in a nightclub, played by Carolyn Jones, who gets stabbed with a cigarette butt by Lee Marvin. And then, of course, you've got Debbie, who is the girlfriend of Vince Stone, the Lee Marvin criminal character, who's one of Jacana's henchmen, who ends up with half of her face burnt by scalding coffee and ends up dying at the end just because this guy has got no nuance to him and just wants to go and bust down all the doors rather than do meticulous and careful police work to catch these guys and get them done. So basically, Glenn Ford is left the last man standing in this because all the women have been basically nuked by his actions directly or indirectly, which is kind of nasty and cruel, and I think Fritz Lang was well aware of it at the time. Now, I'm just going to play the trailer for the film just to give you a bit of an idea of it, and then I'll come back and talk about how the individual actors are in the film and why I like it, in spite of the fact that Banyan is a bit of a prick.
Came here to my home about a murder.
Get rid of him.
Let's go, mister.
What's your pitch, Lucy?
What is this information you have?
Stop the cross-examination. I didn't come up here to talk out of school.
Why did you come up?
Why don't we call it research or something?
check with Lagana first. He might not approve.
I'll have your badge and gun, now.
It's yours. Permanently.
I asked for your gun, too.
It doesn't belong to the department, it's mine.
I'm warning you officially. Don't try to use it.
Okay, so there it is in all its bombastic glory, the trailer. The actors in... I've been thinking about that, and I looked at the bit in the Lee Marvin biography, Point Blank, about this movie. And what Lee Marvin says contradicts what Glenn Ford says about Fritz Lang. Lee Marvin implies that Fritz Lang didn't like Glenn Ford. And then that got me to thinking, and I was thinking for about 20 minutes there in between. And it occurred to me that Glenn Ford's an interesting actor in a kind of slightly negative way, in that he's in a lot of great films, but he's not the best thing in any of those films, if you know what I mean. And in The Big Heat, that's the same thing. The only thing I know that I really like Glenn Ford in more than anything else is a movie from 1951 called Follow the Sun, where he plays the golfer Ben Hogan. And he does it really well, and he's likable, and it's not, they're not trying to fit him into a tough guy mold. I think he's much better, more as an everyday good guy kind of actor that they try to squeeze into that with movies like this one, of course, in Gilda. I don't think that was Glenn Ford's best work when he was trying to play a tough guy, even though he does a kind of journeyman job of it. Not at his best. Now, Lee Marvin in this, on the other hand, Lee Marvin, interesting guy, and I recommend you read the biography of him called Point Blank. Really interesting guy. He was injured on the Battle of Saipan in his late teens and spent 4 or 5 or 6 months recuperating from that. He got shot in the ass, basically. But the bullet tumbled and left a lot of damage that needed time to be repaired. And here we've got a 29-year-old Lee Marvin really in his first impressive role as Vince Stone, the thug. And Vince is an interesting character. He lives in a penthouse. He's got a beautiful girlfriend played by Gloria Graham. But he's still down on the streets, and you can tell that. He's got a nice suit. He's got a very stylish apartment. He has a girlfriend of impressive attractiveness, and yet he's still a thug and acts accordingly. And Lee Marvin, basically, the tough guy part of Lee Marvin is played really well in this. And that then brings us to Gloria Graham, who had just won an Oscar for The Bad and the Beautiful, my all-time favorite movie. And in this one, and I've mentioned this before, but I will mention it again for people who've come in late. Gloria Graham was married to Nicholas Ray, the director, and Nicholas Ray caught her in bed with his teenage son at around this time. And Gloria Graham, one of the interesting things about her, particularly playing the role she plays in this movie, and the character's name is Debbie, is apart from the fact that she's an incredibly attractive woman, there's a forthright and open sexuality about the character that it's kind of rare in movies of this time. The studio wanted to borrow Marilyn Monroe to play the Debbie role in this film, but they couldn't cut the deal. But I don't think Marilyn Monroe would have been as good in this as Gloria Graham was. I think Gloria Graham was a much better actor in a lot of ways than Marilyn Monroe. Her Debbie is forthright about her sexuality. She's not a nice person in a lot of ways, and she's also challenging to Vince and other men. There's a kind of an antagonistic sexuality to her that's really kind of interesting. Later on, she has a talk with Glenn Ford after his wife has died, and they're sitting on either end of a bed, and there's a little bit of it in that trailer there. But I mean, she's there for quite a specific reason. He's there to pump her for information, and she's there to be pumped, but not for information. And that kind of makes for an interesting dynamic there. To be honest with you, it's one of those ones. You know how in certain times in movies you see a character refuse a sexual advance by a female character, and if you're a guy, you think, you idiot. This is a you idiot moment for me. I think that in spite of the fact his wife got blown up. If Gloria Graham, as she looked then, was sitting on the other end of a bed with me, at the very, very, very least, I would be extremely tempted. And there's no sign of that in Glenn Ford's character. A better actor, perhaps, would have had a slight ambivalence about it and found a way to essay that he was interested, but it was too soon and he had other agendas. But no, just on this one, Glenn Ford plays it like a priest, which is probably not the way to do it. And again, this is another reason why I think Glenn Ford wasn't particularly good in the role. There's no subtlety to it, even though there is subtlety and a character arc of redemption in the Debbie character, which is really interesting. Now, you then get on to the other actors. Jeanette Nolan is very, very good as Bertha. She's a mean-spirited and mean woman who basically is looking for an ongoing income stream by blackmailing the biggest crim in town, which is never something that's going to end well. You've got Alexander Scorby, who's very good as Chicana. He's upmarket, lives in a big house. He has police guards outside his house. That's how much the corruption is in the town. And his daughter's having a party with her friends when the policeman Banyan comes in to visit. That kind of thing. You've got that family man facade over the thug. And Scorby does that very well. He dresses very dapper, but he's still got a bit of the streets in his accent. And, he does bring a good sense of menace to the character as well. Now, there's some other actors in there who are worth noting. Let's see, I've just got to get a few names because I'm about due for my medication, being a dose of caffeine. Peter Whitney, big character actor, big bruising character actor, plays Tierney, a bartender in that, who's quite good. Jocelyn Brando playing Katie Banyan, the wife of Dave Banyan, the Glenn Ford character. Jocelyn Brando was Marlon Brando's older sister, who went into acting just as Marlon became big, and herself was a good actor. I'll have an extremely long career in acting, but in this one she plays the Katie Banyan character much better than Glenn Ford plays the Dave Banyan character, even though it's a little bit of a role where she's playing the supportive wife kind of thing who looks after the kids and looks after the home while the husband's out being a cop and that kind of thing. But she does bring some subtlety and some nuance and quite a decent set of acting skills to this particular role, even though it does end with a bang. And I think she would have had a career in spite of the fact that the brother was the biggest actor in the world at the time. Then you've got Willis Boucher playing Lieutenant Ted Wilkes, who's Banyan's boss. He's not the one who asked him for his badge. That's Howard Wendell playing Police Commissioner Higgins. But Willis Boucher was an interesting actor. Didn't start acting till he was 44. And then got a whole bunch of different roles playing cops and other things. And he's quite good in this one. And again, he has a character arc. And then you've got Adam Williams playing Larry Gordon, the crim who set the bomb in the car that blew up Banyan's wife. He's quite good in this as well. Really a good, solid kind of bad guy actor. And he kind of had a long career working in TV up until the late 70s as well. He's just got one of those faces that you know screams henchman to you. And in this film, he does quite well at it as well. Of course, now we get to the fact that Lee Marvin throws the hot coffee over Gloria Graham's face, scarring the side of it. Now, I've got a theory about that scene. If you have a look at the scene, he picks a coffee pot off the hot plate, and the electric hot plate, and throws the coffee over. She screams and she has severe scarring on her face. Now, in the real world, coffee doesn't leave those sort of scars. Yeah, it'll leave great big blisters and things like that, but you won't get the permanent scarring from hot liquid to make the rest of the plot unfold the way it does in this film. Now, if you have a look at the scene carefully, and Fritz Lang did have a lot of fights with the censors over the violence in this film, and I think in a less censorious environment may have gone another way. If you see him pick up the coffee, the hot plate underneath it is like an easily unpluggable electric hot plate just sitting on a sideboard. Now, here's my theory, is that Fritz Lang wanted to use the hot plate to burn Debbie with rather than the scalding coffee, which would have given the kind of scarring that needs to go on for her to realise she's permanently scarred and to betray Vince and Jacana and all that and help Banyan finish the criminal gang. That's just my theory on that. But I think she's great in that she brings that tragedy of a very beautiful woman marred across really well, and does realise that she can't rely on her looks anymore, and then needs to, yeah, she wants to get revenge, and yeah, she's as much a revenge engine as Banyan is in this film. But she kind of does have that arc where she realises she got to do the right thing, and indeed does it in her own kind of way, and gets revenge on Vince, and gets revenge on Bertha, and basically does a lot of the heavy lifting dramatically for Glenn Ford in the film. And I kind of like that. I like the fact that she's not just a victim. Yes, she's been victimized by Vince, and she does talk about the socioeconomic reasons why an attractive woman would go with somebody like Vince. And that's kind of a light, nice piece of nuance to the role. And I think that the two characters that you remember most in this film are Lee Marvin, of course, and Gloria Graham. They're the strongest actors in the piece. And so they draw attention to themselves. When Glenn Ford's in the room, you're looking at everybody else but Glenn Ford. When Gloria Graham's in the room, or Lee Marvin's in the room, you're looking at them. I think that's the big telling difference in this film. And the thing that's made it as well known as it is, and as classic a film noir, and as classic a piece of cinema as it is. Those two very fine actors doing what they do and playing to what they know. Lee Marvin was a genuine tough guy. You don't take over dozens of islands in the Pacific during World War II as an infantryman and not end up with nothing to prove and with a sense of what real toughness is as opposed to television and movie toughness. And I think that Lee Marvin does it. And I think Gloria Graham, being, from all reports, a very sexually and sensually aware woman, and also having chops as an actor, really brings across what this role needs. So the genuineness and the personal qualities of the actors are what lifts this movie above the ordinary. And of course, Fritz Lang and the screenplay by Sidney Bohm, which was based on a Saturday Evening Post serial by William P. McGiven. But Sidney Bohm, a really fine screenplay writer, a former news reporter as well. He did a whole bunch of films that I like, things like Violent Saturday. He wrote the screenplay to that, Secret of the Incas with Charlton Heston. Of course, he did the big heat here. When Worlds Collide, he did the soundtrack, the screenplay, to When Worlds Collide. Mystery Street with Ricardo Montalban. Six Bridges to Cross, which is another fine crime movie. And he did some TV series as well. Naked City, he did a whole bunch of episodes of Naked City. He did an interesting George Maharas movie that I kind of like from the 1960s, which was directed by Gordon Douglas, called Sylvia, with Carol Baker and George Maharas in it, which is a little bit interesting. And it's got a very nice David Rexon soundtrack to it as well. So basically, it's this one should be in your collection, ultimately. And again, like Inherit the Wind, it's one of those ones that you can dip into every 3-5 years, not any more than that, because you don't want to spoil the fun of it. And while I don't think it's, I mean, I could probably name a half a dozen films noir that are better than this one, this one does have that interesting twist of the kind of rogue cop basically destroying the lives of other people to fulfill his goals. And that moral ambiguity that comes of that. It's got the Lee Marvin, it's got the Gloria Graham, and it's got the Fritz Lang, and that's all you need to know. So I'm going to take another break, and when I get back, I will be doing feedback.
My little brown bowl with the silver reminding me of a memory that's haunting me. And peruse this ageless tale of a love that failed to ever become true. On this page is the date of that fateful night at 8 when I found you were no longer in love. There's nothing more, just a dark and futile door that shuts out the stars above. In
that was Gloria Lynn with My Little Brown Book. And we've got some feedback. Surprise, surprise. This one's headed with new listener dishing out accolades. It's from FX James. And he says, what a fantastic podcast you have. I've just started listening this month and I've already downloaded a bushel of your terrific work. Love the Rod Taylor one especially. Excellent commentary, great audio clips and brilliant song choices. And that Sal sounds like a real doll. I now have a gold doubloon of all film podcast wealth. On one side, there's the wonderful Paleo Cinema podcast, and on the flip side, that lovable, dastardly duo, Silver and Gold. I agree. Shout out to Alex and John. I also enjoy the Down Under connection. As a British youth, now an old fuck living in America, I backpacked all up and down the eastern seaboard of Australia and had many wild nights in that gorgeous city, Sydney. Even got picked up by the harbour police one drunken night after leaping into the water from the wall surrounding the Sydney Opera House. So again, many thanks for the excellent show. Yep, thanks for that, FX. I don't recommend you jump over the seawall again near the Opera House for the simple reason that if the tide's out, you're going to hit a rock. I know the tides around there pretty well. I've fished off that wall. And yes, you've got to be very careful. I mean, on the other hand, there are a number of nude beaches around Middle Head that may be much more interesting places to swim if you ever get to go there and do that again. But yeah, thanks for the feedback. And yeah, I agree with what you say about Silver and Gold as well. Those guys rock. As indeed do Samurai and Big Willie over at Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema, and as the Brin does over at Amicus, and of course there are the Mob over at 1951 Down Place, amongst many others, and if I've forgotten people, and of course Morris over at Love That Album, and all the other people out there whose links are on the Paleo Cinema website, and of course Vince, Mary, Nick, and the Mob over at the B-Movie Cast. So there's a few tips for you that you might want to listen to as well, as long as you just don't stop listening to me, of course. So thank you for that one. Now let's see what else we've got. Ian Fryer has done an email as well, which is always nice. Thank you, Ian. Actually, I misspoke. He's done two emails, but I'll read them one at a time. Hi, Terry. Sorry I haven't been in touch with any feedback lately, though I've been keeping up with both Paleo Cinema and Martian Drive-In podcasts, which have made some long, lonely car journeys a lot more entertaining. I enjoyed Paleo Cinema 120 very much. Haven't seen His Majesty O'Keefe, but keep hearing about it. Did remind me of an Australian actor I grew up watching, Grant Taylor. He played the recurring character General Henderson in Gerry Anderson's UFO in 1969 and 1970, the last acting work he did, as he was suffering from cancer and is visibly ill in his last episode, the absolutely marvellous story Mindbender. He still gave it his all, giving a fierce, totally committed performance. It's been a few years since I've seen The Magic Christian, but it was good to be reminded of the film and the love the Beatles had for the Goon Show. This even came out occasionally in John Lennon's Beatles songs. There's a Lennon song from the band's hippiest period called What's the New Mary Jane, which never made it to an official release in the band's lifetime, but can be found on from various sources, which uses Spike Milligan's trademark I'm Walking Backwards for Christmas piano sound. Two scenes from Magic Christian really stand out for me. Firstly, Lawrence Harvey's Hamlet soliloquy. Geez, he's thin. He had been quite a podgy young man and was rumoured to have gone to extreme measures to lose weight, with dire effect to his long-term health. The second visual memory is Christopher Lee's Dracula stalking the corridors of the Magic Christian cruise liner, his cape flowing behind him. Joseph McGrath is rarely regarded as a visual stylist, but his mobile camera gives these scenes a genuine unsettling edge, and I only wish any of the directors of his Hammer films used his physical presence in such a way. He was quite underused in the later Dracula movies, which was a shame, and that he's talking about Christopher Lee. Anyway, best wishes to you and Sal, and happy birthday to my partner Jackie, who turned 60 tomorrow. I really don't know how I got so lucky. Best wishes, Ian. And happy birthday to Jackie, even though it's probably a little late for that, but always happy to offer wishes to people. That's all got there. And again, Ian follows up with, hi again, Terry. Read my previous message about the Magic Christian. Reading Roy Carr's book, Beatles at the Movies, reminded me of the biggest single Goon Show influence in the Beatles' movie career, which should have occurred to me earlier. Richard Lester, the Beatles were big fans of Lester's Running, Jumping, Standing Still film, an 11-minute short film starring Peter Sellers, Spike Milligan, and Lester himself. And he was hired for A Hard Day's Night on the strength of it. Lester's zippy, inventive visual sense chimed perfectly with Spike Milligan's balmy, free-form humour. I also had a thing for Richard Lester's movies, having been introduced to them with The Three Musketeers, which has a lovely sense that behind the great sweep of events starring the film's heroes, there is a cast of muttering servants doing real-life stuff like making sure everyone got fed and the stables were cleaned. Ian. Yeah, I agree. My favourite Three Musketeers is still the one from the 1940s, which has got Gene Kelly and Lana Turner in it, but the 1970s one's pretty good. The most recent one, which had Mila Jovovich in it, less so. But Richard Lester's visual style, I think that it was perfect for the time it was in. The 1960s had that kind of anarchic, playful feel about them in a lot of the world, particularly around London, of course. And Lester stuff taps into that perfectly. There are people who surf the zeitgeist really well, and Richard Lester was one of them. Later on, of course, he was out of fashion to a greater extent, but a lot of the stuff he did then were just, he's a bit like early career Michael Caine or Terrence Stamp or one of those guys. He's very much part of that 60s crowd, or Julie Christie or something like that. He's, in my mind, he's linked into all of those really good English actors of the time, Peter O'Toole as well, who hit their peak at the 60s but ended up having long careers after that. That was one of the other things I saw the other day that reminded me of that era, which was Albert Finney in Skyfall playing the groundskeeper at James Bond's ancestral home. And he has some great little bits of business there and shows just how good an old actor can be in a small role. And I really liked him doing that because he essayed humour and toughness as well and gets to shoot off a double-barrel sawn-off shotgun at some villains, which is never a bad thing for an actor to do. So thank you for that, Ian. Anyway, that's about it this time around. I'll be back in a little while with another Paleo Cinema podcast. In the meantime, follow all of the links on the Paleo Cinema webpage to other fine podcasts. People are doing this for the love of it, and they want to share that love with you, and just go and download their stuff to do so. And I'll be back very soon. It's November now, and the weather is getting warmer and we're heading into the Christmas season, and I've got to help Sal prepare for her big 4-0 birthday. So I'll be back soon, and in the meantime, look after yourselves and enjoy all the movies you see. Bye.
This concludes the broadcast from World Control.